Here at Renew Energy Partners, climate change is very important to us, and so is beer. In every episode of the Green Beers podcast, we taste a beer together. We talk about the brewery and their sustainability practices. And then we talk about a topic relating to our work in decarbonizing buildings and mitigating climate change.
Welcome to Green Beers. My name is Mike Savage, and I'm here with
Charlie Lord,
Nathan Montgomery.
And our special guest today is the director for the Supplier Partnership for the Environment, Kellen Mahoney. Please introduce yourself.
Hey, Mike. Thank you. Kellen Mahoney here with Suppliers Partnership for the Environment. And we are an industry coalition that brings automakers and suppliers together to collaborate on sustainability goals.
Great. Welcome, Kellen. Good to see you again.
Yeah.
Good to see you.
We joined SBE probably just coming on a year ago, last April. And I got to say, we really love the group that you all have put together. It's one of, I will say, probably the best. I think it is the best networking group we've been a part of. The fact that you guys meet quarterly and you really work on challenges is just different, right? It's not just some group that says, here's some content. It's a group that works towards, you know, pulling together solutions. So my question for you is, you know, what's the background on SBE? How did you get started? And Charlie's trying to jump into the important stuff here.
I want to open the beer. So I want to open the beer before we get to that.
Yeah, it's an important question, but all right, you think on that. We're going
to
open.
Yes, you have some time to work.
All right.
While we pour this beer, I want to relate that I have made my own beer twice. And the first time I made beer, I used this recipe. I'm assuming that's, you know, it's a patterned after the recipe. It's not still. So I'm excited. You know, I certainly didn't come anywhere near to replicating this, which is Dale's American Pale Ale. And the brewery is
Oscar Blues.
Oscar Blues from
Longmont,
Colorado. Yeah.
Wonderful. Wonderful. The objective here is that we talk about the beer, but we don't rate it. We got to save the ratings for the end. That way we build some suspense. People wonder what's going on. Do we like it? And so forth.
Kellen, you got your Oscar Blues Dale's Pale Ale.
Yeah.
Excellent. Okay. All right. We've got the beer.
It's good. It's good. I won't say more than that.
I didn't make anything near as good. It is good.
So to the important stuff, SBE, how did that get started?
Yeah. So Mike, you know, first it's great to hear your perspective on, you know, SBE's philosophy, right? Of moving from talking about stuff to actually, you know, tangible change. And I'd say, you know, that has been, you know, part of the culture and sort of philosophy of this group from its beginning, which I think at the time was quite, you know, maybe ahead of his time. And I wasn't there, but, you know, back in the early 2000s, you know, a group of companies came together and started to, you know, recognize the importance of their supply chain, you know, in terms of their own environmental goals. And, you know, working originally through General Motors and then later through, you know, a broader group of automotive companies, you know, by engaging some of their direct suppliers, you know, realized that those suppliers were able to tell them some things about, you know, their own environmental risks and opportunities that they, you know, they weren't seeing internally. And the same thing on the supplier side, right? Realizing that the OEMs were a lot more mature, had a lot more experience, and there were some quick wins that suppliers could gain right away, right? By working together. And it was, you know, from that very, you know, as a small beginning, just 6 to 8 people sitting around the table sort of talking, that SP was born in 2002. But from the start, it's really been, you know, just that it's a forum to get automakers, suppliers together, you know, for candid, open conversation around environmental sustainability opportunities that ideally, you know, moves from talk to action, right, to helping those companies make meaningful progress. And so that was the start back in the early 2000s. And it's grown, you know, quite a bit from there.
There was a great post, I think, that came from you guys that our colleague Aurora commented on today about how you would describe scope three emissions. I think it came from Oliver.
Yeah.
But there was a great post on LinkedIn today about how you would describe scope three emissions to a classroom of fourth graders. And so we'll take our own cut at that. But Kellen, it's really a powerful work that you all do, focusing on the suppliers to the ultimate manufacturers, in this case, in the auto industry. And we talked about it before, but it'd be great from here to hear in your own words, you know, how that fits into the larger, you know, decarbonization conversation and sustainability conversation generally. What is scope one, scope two, and scope three, and why is scope three so important?
Yeah, no, absolutely. So, you know, SP's been working in this space for, you know, 20 plus years now. And, you know, from the beginning, our focus was on the supply chain. But I would say, you know, in the last 3 to 5 years, that focus has amplified, you know, hugely across our members. And I think, you know, for many years, you know, there was a focus around operational efficiencies, you know, within manufacturing sites. There was a focus, rightly so, on the product, the use phase emissions of vehicles. But, you know, as we look forward and you see the vehicles transitioning to zero emissions, right, there's a huge bucket of emissions now in the supply chain. And that, as we see that scope three, you know, product use phase emissions gradually, you know, shift down as we move to EVs and other transportation methods, the remaining, you know, category one scope three emissions are very significant. And I'd say the biggest, you know, next phase that we need to address. So we have been working really as companies are moving through that journey, you know, moving from setting decarbonization targets first at an enterprise level, then in terms of their operations and their products, to now looking at their full value chains. You know, how do we prepare them to address that? And how do we help those suppliers sort of navigate the complexities of all the different asks that they're receiving? And so we have very much seen, you know, an evolution from a long-time focus on scope one and two emissions, where, you know, most of our companies have, you know, great energy efficiency programs in place. They're doing great work within their own operations. And now the question is, how do we scale that to, you know, thousands of suppliers that are at very different stages of the maturity?
Yeah.
So I'd say as we move forward, you know, the scope three aspect of this, and particularly the category one purchase goods and services, is, you know, I think the biggest target, the biggest challenge, you know, for us to address as we move forward. And so I think, you know, we are really excited. There's a lot of challenges that come with that, but we're really excited at that opportunity. And it's shifting, you know, what was many years ago sort of a voluntary conversation. Let's see how we can get people in the room, help our suppliers, to what is clearly, you know, competitive, you know, opportunity for the supply chain and a regulatory requirement in terms of getting that level of carbon data, right? So, you know, we see scope three really as a huge opportunity moving forward.
Yeah, it's massive. And I don't know the numbers for automotive. I know industry, sort of commercial, industrial wide, about scope three represents about 70% of emissions. So, and certainly today is not, you know, the 1920s where, you know, wood and rubber would go inside of, you know, one side of a factory and Henry Ford would convert that into, you know, the Model T on the other end. I mean, I think there's, as you just mentioned, right, there's thousands of suppliers now, and you know, these automotive manufacturers are really assemblers, right, and design engineer firms. And so massive scale of opportunity. And I want,
and as you point out, Mike, a huge ecosystem of companies have to deal with. It's not four suppliers or five suppliers, it's hundreds.
Yeah. It's an amazing opportunity. And where do you see the, in terms of your personal history, how have you seen that evolution sort of evolve? You know, I think you've been there about 15 years now, or give or take.
Yeah. Yeah. So I've been involved in various capacities for a while, and that has shifted, you know, significantly over that time period. But I would say, you know, so many companies for a long time have been working to engage their strategic suppliers, you know, those companies that represent, you know, let's say 80% of their total spend. But I think what we're seeing now is, you know, looking at some increased, you know, investor pressures, looking at increased regulations, getting to more granular data, and looking at, you know, more ambitious, you know, long-term decarbonization targets that many of our member companies have committed to, that scale is and needs to move well beyond, you know, that smaller group, let's say that top 80%, to just about everybody. And when we think about what that entails, so, you know, a vehicle, just sort of rough numbers, an average vehicle might have, you know, 30,000 individual components going down to every sort of nut and bolt within a vehicle. That's a traditional, you know, internal combustion vehicle. An EV might have 20% fewer, but still a huge number of individual parts, right? And then that's not taking into account, you know, the packaging materials that need to ship all those into the supply chain, you know, the robotics, the capital equipment in all the facilities. So, you know, we're talking about a huge extended global supply chain. And the challenge, I think, moving forward, you know, how do we get everybody on board here? To companies that are much smaller, you know, don't have internal resources and capacity to deal with this, probably have no idea what scope 1, 2, and 3 emissions may even mean, right? So I think that where we're seeing that evolution is starting to think about, you know, how do we really scale this, right? To include all of those suppliers, make it as easy as possible for them to understand what the expectations are, what the data is that they need to report. And I think most importantly, what they can do to actually make tangible change to support that, you know, to support that growth. But that evolution, I would say just in the last 3 years, you know, really seeing that scale from the small group to, you know, how do we start to think about bringing everybody in?
Yeah, and I'm picking up on that, Kellen. So, you know, you guys have a long track record of helping a wide ecosystem to tackle sustainability issues. And as you pointed out, and as Mike mentioned, to really make tangible progress and focus on solutions. What are you seeing in terms of the decarbonization journey for your members? I'm assuming they all start at very different places, but do you have a lot of them that are really in the early days and are saying, how do I even identify what my baseline is, and how would I even begin to think about implementing projects? Sort of what's the landscape look like in terms of where they are and where they want to go?
Yeah, so it's a great question. I would say, you know, historically, we have tended to attract, you know, companies that are a bit more mature on their journey. And, you know, as a group that focuses solely on sustainability, you know, we tend to attract companies that are already working in that space. But I would say, you know, more recently, we are seeing a much broader range of companies, you know, come to us looking for, you know, looking for answers and wanting to talk about this. And so I think going forward, we are seeing a lot more companies that are really at that very first stage. You know, they might have somebody internally that's responding to customer requests. They may have some internal energy management experience. But as we're thinking about, you know, the level of the requests, as companies are starting to push suppliers to set something like a science-based target, for example, you know, starting to push suppliers to consider sourcing renewable energy, you know, looking at a product carbon footprint in terms of their design decisions. I'd say the majority of the supply chain, you know, is very early in the journey of being able to respond to any of that. So I think really starting with education, engagement, awareness, I think is a big opportunity as we move forward to get beyond, you know, that small group of very mature companies to a lot of different companies that are very different stages in their journey right now.
Yeah, it's a very interesting observation. I mean, it's just the kind of thing that only a group at the front edge of this would know. But to see that the member groups and the interested suppliers has grown from the early adopters to a deeper network, including a lot more first timers, just is sort of tangible evidence on the ground of the fact that the pressures are mounting. You've mentioned it a couple times, Kellen. Whether it's customers that are demanding it or investors that are demanding it, there's whether it's regulatory, you know, it makes sense that they would turn and the suppliers would turn and say, well, where do I go to figure this out? And they'd come to you. But the fact that you're seeing more first timers is sort of evidence on the ground that it's really actually happening. Yeah.
Absolutely. And I think Callum, one of the points you brought up is around education, and that's where I think the supplier partnership is in a league of its own. And you know, the first event I went to last April, you know, it just felt different. You know, there was multiple breakout sessions, and it wasn't just, you know, hey, we're being talked at for 2 hours on what's the best practice. It was, no, let's break up in small groups. And if you weren't participating, you know, Steve was going to, you know, yell at you and pull you into the conversation. But even so, just like the idea of breaking the group into smaller teams and getting feedback from everybody and forcing, you know, dialogue, I think it just goes back to, right, like you can tell somebody to do something, but if they come to that realization themselves and they're part of that decision-making process, I think it's brilliant. And I guess my question is, has that always been a part of supplier partnership, or where did this sort of cohort kind of, you know, leadership style or education style come from?
Yeah, so it's a great point. One of our sort of core philosophies is around, you know, that opportunity for two-way communication. And so I think that has been something that luckily was really baked into the mission of the group from the start. You know, there are certain groups that are all the OEMs, or there's certain groups that are all the suppliers, but this was really intended to be, you know, it should be both together. How do we work together, you know, understand each other's perspectives and hopefully come out of that, you know, with sort of the magic in the middle of what makes the most sense, you know, across the supply chain. And I would say, you know, there's been a lot of examples of that. And I think, you know, it's important to note, like, everybody has the best intention. We're all trying to, you know, make progress on sustainability, but it's moving really fast. And you often don't, you know, you don't know everything. You might not know the unintended consequences of some of the things you're thinking about. So there have been a lot of great examples where, you know, having that conversation between an OEM and a group of suppliers, you know, might flag something that they would have otherwise missed, and, you know, find a better way to do that. And I'll, you know, one example, you know, we worked on a packaging sustainability project several years ago where a group of OEMs came together. You know, they said, you know, in terms of our zero waste goals, packaging remains one of the biggest challenges we have to face. And, you know, they put together a list of, you know, common packaging materials that were problematic for them to handle. That was great. Like, there was strong alignment from the OEMs. There was clear best practices in what made sense to improve the sustainability of those packaging materials. But as we took that to suppliers, you know, they immediately said, yes, like, we agree with this direction. We want to work with you to improve, you know, packaging recyclability, but some of these materials we absolutely need from a quality perspective, and there's not necessarily a great alternative. You know, some of these materials we're using for safety and ergonomic purposes, and, you know, if we were to change this, you know, for a recyclability perspective, it would make a real impact on our operations. And so, you know, by having that sort of two-way dialogue, the team then came out with some recommendations, some guidance that made sense, right, on both sides of the table. And it was that second version that had the supplier input where we saw a huge uptick, right, in terms of now we have something that suppliers, as you said, Mike, earlier, they're sort of bought into, they're ready to work, you know. And so I think anytime we can have that two-way dialogue, that's always, I think, we're better for it at the end of the day.
Yeah, I mean, that's really interesting story, because it's all well and good to come up with ideas, but if you're focused on outcomes, it doesn't mean anything unless it's adopted at the supplier level. It doesn't actually make change. And on that point, I mean, there are maybe no groups that are as deeply embedded in a larger industrial ecosystem than SPE around issues of sustainability and decarbonization. So you sort of see the landscape, you know the players. What's your prediction about how quickly we can make tangible progress in decarbonizing these supply, you know, this supply chain? You know, are you seeing enough creativity and enough buy-in to have breakthroughs that we haven't even thought of and hit our 2030 goals?
So I would say, you know, we are seeing significant energy and momentum behind decarbonization goals. I would say, I think, as a general statement, it is among the top priorities of almost every one of our member companies, is their, you know, their decarbonization targets. And, you know, we have companies where, you know, several companies where, you know, a few years ago, they might not have had anyone, you know, within their procurement group focused on scope 3 emissions. And now they have entire teams that are focused on scope 3 emissions. So I think, you know, they're putting resources and people behind this that, you know, shows that how serious they are. But I would share, you know, one example. So we worked probably 3 years ago with some of our members to develop some guidelines around carbon reporting, carbon reduction, you know, trying to set a common framework for suppliers in terms of what might, you know, be a path forward there to at least get them started. From that, you know, working with groups like Manufacture 2030 and others to then share those guidelines, you know, we've seen that growing again from a small group of companies to over 12,000 manufacturing sites in scope last year is starting to receive those requests. And so I think I'm excited to see how quickly some of this has moved just in a couple of years in terms of companies, you know, dedicating resources, really scaling some of these requests to their supply chain. And I think we will see that, you know, see that level of momentum continue here.
Yeah, that's a great example of what happens when you hit the tipping point. You know, that's a remarkable number and a remarkable level of engagement. And probably 1, 3, or 4 years ago, you would have said, I hope we can get to that, but I can't guarantee it. Yeah. And now absolutely. And now we're at the moment where the data is starting to come in. And the question is, how are we going to implement, you know, projects on the ground to actually decarbonize these facilities? And yeah, is it hard? Sure. But when you put this much energy into it and people are committing resources to resolving it, we may see outcomes 3 or 4 years down the road that we couldn't even imagine right now.
Yep. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, we're coming, you know, and about halfway through the decade, and it's exciting. The opportunities that are coming on here. I'm wondering, Kellen, just in terms of your personal background, what led you to get into this space, and what excites you about the future?
Yeah, so you know, in terms of my personal background, I worked for a company, you know, that really specializes in building industry coalitions, building trade associations, and sort of pre-competitive collaborations. And prior to my work, you know, with this group, I was working with various other industry groups, you know, around sustainability. But as some of my, you know, peers moved into other roles, you know, I had an opportunity to shift into this group. And I would say, you know, I think as you said in the opening, Mike, just the culture of this group, you know, immediately drew me to want to be, you know, much more heavily involved, right? Just seeing, you know, we're not just going to get together and sort of talk about things and have an academic conversation, but we're going to focus on how can we make meaningful progress together. And so that, I think, has been the biggest piece that continues to excite me, is that, you know, is that culture and is that willingness from our members to have these difficult, you know, candid conversations about, you know, the pros and cons of, you know, different sustainability opportunities, but, you know, all with the idea that, you know, we are in this together to drive toward that common sustainability mission, right? And so that has been really exciting for me. And I think as we move forward, seeing things that, you know, as you just said, Charlie, seeing things we talked about years ago as sort of a dream start to be just an expectation. Like there's a clear expectation now, of course, we'll engage our suppliers. Of course, you know, we need to move beyond our own four walls. I'm excited to see, you know, where that continues to go and the opportunities ahead of us to really help those companies that are a lot earlier in their journey, you know, sort of access, you know, great resources like your company, access, you know, expertise within the industry to help them take those first steps to make that, you know, progress, hopefully all the more quick.
No, that's a great answer. And I think, you know, all this progress it's going to lead to, right? Eventually we're going to get there, right? The question that I just kind of like in the back of my mind is, seeing some of these targets, some of these companies like net zero supply chain, like I don't even know what that means. Like, and I'm wondering, Cal, like, and the answer could be no, and that's totally fine. But like, do you have an idea on what, you know, what the future, like how do we get there to, you know, actually, you know, as some companies do have like these net zero supply chain goals by obviously not 2030, by 2040, 2050. And I know, you know, we got a lot of work to do to get to 2030, but I'm just, you know, I'm an optimist and I'll look forward to seeing what the future holds. Just any thoughts there?
Yeah, so we have seen several companies make public commitments to a net zero supply chain, and how you define net zero, we can leave for another discussion. But I would say it's hugely ambitious. It's hugely challenging, but I think there is some great progress that's being made. And you know, as we look at that, you know, within the automotive sector, you know, one of the opportunities I see for, you know, collaboration is a lot of those big carbon hotspots are in very, you know, clear shared commodities. So we can look at, you know, the steel, the aluminum that make up most of the body and some of the other components of the vehicle. You know, that's a very significant carbon hotspot where I think generally, you know, as an industry, as, you know, globally, we know what the answers are to decarbonize those processes. It's very expensive and it's a long-term game, but, you know, the answers are there. It's a matter of, do we see enough momentum? Do we see enough investment behind them? And maybe how can we partner to support that kind of type of investment? You know, the same thing around the battery, you know, a lot of investment in batteries that's moving toward these more low carbon materials. And I'm always thrilled when I see a company announcing a new battery material partnership that's talking, you know, within their investor press releases about the work that they did to qualify the carbon, you know, qualifications of that supplier, right? So I think we are seeing really, really good progress here, but there is, as you said, there's a long way to go to 2050 to get there. And I think the biggest challenge, you know, those are well-defined, sort of well-understood, you know, commodity groups. The biggest challenge is how do we get to those small and medium-sized businesses deep within the supply chain that you know, don't have the resources, don't have you know, the personnel to dedicate to this. And even if we give them lots of education, just that ability to take their eye off the ball in terms of manufacturing their product with the small teams that they have to then go implement them, right? I think there's a lot of support that's going to be needed on the small and medium-sized business side of this to really get you know, again, if we're going to get everybody in, there's a lot of challenges ahead of us there. But again, I'm excited about the momentum we see in the companies that are working to sort of think through how do we get there in the interim.
Yeah, you know, a couple observations. It's really fascinating. First of all, to your question, Mike, if they don't make the kind of remarkable goal, if they don't set the remarkable goal that we can't actually see how you get to, then you don't get the follow-on questions, which is actually a very interesting point about that you just pointed out, Kellen. Once you ask the question, what is net zero or how would you get there, then you have the driver to unpack where is the carbon, right? And you identify the extent to which it's in, say, a lot of it is in certain hotspots. And then there's a potential for partnerships, right? So if we know that the steel and the aluminum, there are people working on alternative materials that across industries, and of which auto is one. So now there's this sort of powerful sort of flywheel that turns innovation to across a number of industries. And it all starts with setting the aggressive goals, right?
Yep.
So it's pretty cool to think about the what happens when. And then I guess the next point that could just hit me as you were talking, Kellen, is that once these goals are set, the progress is going to be determined by the extent to which the resources are committed from inside these industries and then available from outside, right, to actually answer the questions, to come up with the innovations in battery, to provide support for the small and medium size. So once the goals are there, the next pressure point is inside and outside are the resources being applied to actually drive innovation, because to your point, Mike, we don't actually know how we're going to get there.
Yeah.
But by setting the goal, we sort of force a conversation about, well, what would that look like?
Yeah. Yeah. It's that idea of you set a goal and, you know, it's a big goal. There are not 20 ways to get there. There's only a few, right? And I think collaboration is going to be key, right? It's really multiple industries, major industries outside of just auto that are all going to have to work on this.
Yep.
And that'll be exciting. So I think, Kellen, really appreciate you walking through. I'm just really enjoying the conversation around, sort of the background on SBE and your work there. I'll say it again. It's just a great group. But got a question for you. If you could have a beer with anybody dead or alive, who would it be?
Yeah, I love the question. And, you know, I think there's a lot of directions what you could go with that. But I'll say, you know, drinking this Dale's Pale Ale, you know, the direction I'll take it is, you know, thinking about some of my, you know, musical heroes. So I'm a huge, you know, indie rock music fan. And there's, you know, a guy who has since passed away, but his name was David Berman, originally the Silver Jews and then Purple Mountains, who was hugely important to me, you know, through like my college years and in my 20s, I would say. And so I think he would be a fascinating guy to have a beer with. And there's this line from his first album, you know, that I think is maybe a great quote for this podcast here. Let's hope I get it right. So it was, you know, in 27 years, I've drunk 50,000 beers and they all wash against me like the sea onto a pier. So anyway,
I love that.
That's pretty good.
I love that. May become our tagline. Holy cow, that's fantastic.
He was a great lyricist, and I just think would be a fascinating guy to have a beer with.
He sounds like it. Wow, that's wonderful. So the bands were Purple Mountain.
Purple Mountain and Silver Jews is what he was known for many years.
Wow.
And, you know, it was a small indie rock group, but always a favorite of mine.
That's beautiful. Well, welcome, David Berman. He joins a subset of our cohort of what we call our beer garden of musicians. Nathan here initiated the musician subgroup with Nina Simone, the jazz singer. Have we had the boss? Did somebody say the boss?
I don't think so. But
wow. Okay, so that's out there. But anyway, it's great. David Berman, welcome. Yeah. That's very cool.
It got me thinking. You know, I think I would like to add, you know, John Prine to that list.
Mm-hmm.
I feel like he would be a good hang.
Absolutely, one of the great songwriters of all time.
Yeah. Yeah, for some reason, we would always play John Prine, rocking the kids when they were toddlers.
And did it work?
Yeah,
I mean, look, we're giving parenting advice now. I mean, we gotta cross reference this podcast, cross list it. Did it work?
Yeah, it was something about like smoking a cigarette.
It's all about the rhythm, anyway.
Yeah, but no, Dave Berman. I'll have to give him a listen.
Yeah, absolutely. That's great.
Yeah. So to the beer itself, you know, let's hear a little bit about the brewery, Mr. Montgomery.
All righty. Again, just reiterating, Kellen, great to have you on. It's been a fascinating conversation. Dave Berman, I'm going to have to go listen to him. It's been a long time since I've listened to him. I'll be looking him up again after work. So on to beer, though. We are, again, drinking Dale's Pale Ale, Dale's American Pale Ale, I should say, from Oscar Blues Brewery in Longmont, Colorado, which is just northeast of Boulder. So close to the Front Range. And like Massachusetts, like California, many other states, big brewing culture. And the Oscar Blues Brewery in particular, they have some sustainability initiatives. And I'll remind everybody that when we're rating the beer, we can rate it from 1 to 10 based on how it tastes. Mike, of course, has his crushability score. How many would you want to drink in one sitting? And then,
That's up for interpretation.
True.
It's some combination of want to drink and could actually drink.
Fair. Yeah. Fair. That's fair clarification.
Depends on the beer.
But in terms of the taste rating, 1 through 10, you can add up to 1 sustainability point. So it could be because of the sustainability initiatives. Now it could be a quarter of a point, it could be half a point, a full point, kind of depends on what you're feeling. So in terms of the sustainability solutions and initiatives from Oscar Blues Brewery, one large one was in terms of reducing their packaging and changing how they package their beers, which reduced in 40% cost savings as well as a 64% reduction in secondary packaging materials usage and 73% fewer trucks delivering beer. So just shrinking the size of the 6, 12, and 24 packs, that was a big deal to them. And then in addition, they've worked hard on water savings. So it's originally a Dale's Pale Ale took, it was 5 gallons of water for 1 gallon of Dale's. And now it is 3 gallons of water for 1 of Dale's. So, you know, certainly an improvement, certainly improvement. And they've also, part of the way they did that was to revamp their canning process. Thought it was interesting. The cans were rinsed with water before beer was poured in. That's a pretty common tactic in the manufacturing. But this is uses now deionized air. So it's like they eject air really quickly at the glass to clean it rather than use water. So I thought that was kind of an interesting thought.
Yeah, it's the first time we've heard of deionized air in our sustainability discussions for brewery.
Yeah, and lastly here, what to do with the extra yeast. We have seen this one before. It depends. It could be extra yeast or extra hops, but in this case, it's yeast, and it's being captured and given to local farmers. Which is used as livestock feed. So that is one that we have seen.
Along with their spent grain. Yeah, we've seen that one before.
Right.
Treehouse does it.
Yeah.
Out in Western Mass.
Absolutely. Yep. So those are the three biggest sustainability initiatives that I could find. Certainly making an effort, but then it all comes down to, you know, taste, and do you add the sustainability point?
Yeah, Kellen, what do you think? Scale of 1 to 10 for flavor and possible additional full point for sustainability.
Okay, yeah. So I'll say I don't think I've had this before, and I really like it. So I'm thinking it may be a 9. Great beer, you know, great taste, and so I love it. On the sustainability side, you know, I'll maybe defer to you in terms of how unique what was just shared might be versus other brewers, but I like their focus on water intensity. Like, that's clearly hugely important from, you know, the beverage industry. And the packaging innovation is interesting as well. So it seems like they're making some effort there.
Yeah, it's a good point, Kellen. And as much as you're an expert on supply chains of different sorts, including especially the auto manufacturing sector, we have reviewed a lot of beer sustainability. And I'll tell you that the best in class tend to have significant renewables, production line reductions, mm-hmm. energy efficiency. The water and the spent grain is kind of table stakes for a brewery. The packaging one is interesting, which is why they might get more than a little bump. But yeah, to your point, this is probably run-of-the-mill sustainability efforts, not through the roof.
Maybe like a 0.6?
Yeah, something in there. Yeah. I was thinking a little lower, but we'll get to that. Okay, so Kellen's a 9 with a TBD on sustainability.
I will say it's a beautiful color. It's a beautiful amber honey-colored beer. It tastes like a pale ale. I don't not like it. Probably my typical answer, like a 7 plus 0.6. So that's an 8.3 plus this isn't for me. I wouldn't drink a lot of these.
This is not high on the crushability.
No. This is like a 2 or 3.
This is a good beer. It's a good beer for a pale ale. It's got a lot of depth of flavor. It's got a little of a hoppy finish, but I agree with you. It's a nice color. It's kind of pleasing.
Yeah,
but it's not a through the roof score. I did go back and look at my scores. I was curious, and I have a very narrow band. Kellen, I'm an easy grader. I'm usually between 8.5 and 9.5. I've got 1 6.5 and 1 7.5 in there, but I'm really consistent.
Yeah.
I'm actually going to give this on the lower end of my range because it is a good beer, but there's nothing.
Your palate's expanding.
Yeah, I think I'm Hal's Hispanic. Or maybe I'm getting tougher. Maybe you're rubbing off on me. Yeah. But I'd say this is an 8.5 point for sustainability. Actually, Yeah, I'll say 8.5 total. Yeah,
actually, I was going to go with the same thing, about eight for taste. Good, it's a good pale ale.
Yeah,
it's very tasty. I'll give them a half point for sustainability. And if Kellen, are you okay with a 0.6 that Mike did a 0.6 rating for sustainability?
Yeah. So I'd like to amend my score, an 8.5 for taste with a half a point for sustainability.
Nice.
To give it 9 total. And I also like, you know, and I don't know the history, but looking here on this, that, you know, apparently this was the original craft beer in a can that really helped propel a craft beer movement. I think that's also a really cool part of the story here.
It is. It's a really good point. And in fact, I remember when I was making, I was patterning their recipe.
Stealing.
I think we were guessing. I'm just going to say that. No, I do remember that part of the history, Kellen. This was a pioneer beer in the craft brew industry. So, you know, shout out to them for getting this all started.
Yeah. Well, Kellen, it's been great having you here. One last question. What's your favorite beer?
So right now, there's a couple great local breweries, you know, around my house, and two of them, so Lone Oak Brewery and the Brookfield Beer House, are favorites of mine. And actually, their pale ale I've been drinking regularly. So I'll go with, you know, my local breweries here in Maryland.
Excellent. Well, those are Lone Oak and
the Brookfield Beer Farm.
Nice.
So now I'm in Montgomery County, Maryland. Yeah,
that's great.
Sounds like a nice farm.
Yeah, we'll have to get them on the pod at some point.
Beer grows on trees.
Absolutely.
Before we finish up, I want to give a shout out to my friend, family friend, Phoebe Fry, who gave us a shout out in her blog this week. Phoebe is a chef and a food writer and a recipe tester. She's got a wonderful career in food. Her blog is called The Dish, which provides great suggestions on restaurants and recipes and thoughts on life. It's really a wonderful read. So sign up for The Dish. She gave a nice shout out to the pod in this week's Dish, and specifically our episode on Athletic Beer Company, which is the one that Mike called water and not beer. But she appreciated the guidance on a good tasting non-alcoholic beer. So there you go.
Very good. And with this pale ale specifically, it is rated an 8.6. So it does not break our top five, but I believe cracks our top 10. So certainly one of the higher rated beers that we've rated, but not
through the roof.
Not the upper echelon.
That feels right to me.
Yeah.
We're going to have an upcoming episode where we're going to review the entire list of the beer garden and also go through our beer rankings top to bottom. So that's how probably we'll end season 3. So people out that to look forward to.
Awesome. All righty. Well, thanks all. Till next time. It's been Green Beers.
Thanks, Kellen.
All right. Thank you.
Green Beers is brought to you by Renew Energy Partners, your partner in building decarbonization. Decarbonizing your building is good for the earth and it's a smart business move, but it's complicated and it can cost you a lot of money. Our goal is to decarbonize your building while saving you money, so all of those retrofits pay for themselves. Learn more at renewep.com.